Hello and welcome to this episode of Superhero Ethic. Today we're asking the question, can you blow up the world to help a whole bunch of other people? How does it feel to sit back and watch while all sorts of galactic disasters happen because you're getting ready to prevent something even worse? And is there a way that I can tie in criticizing Cap for his actions in Infinity War to this much bigger discussion about Eternals? Wait and find out all of that after this quick commercial message that I have no control over. But Cap probably does. Welcome back. I'm Matthew, your host. I'm joined today by Pete Wright. Pete is one of the founders of the Next Reel family of podcasts, where the Marvel Movie Minute that I've gotten the honor to help co-host this season about Thor has been on. And Pete and I have been having a lot of great conversations about all things movies and MCU and movies versus long-form TV shows and stuff like that. And realized we were both really interested in this new movie that came out, The Eternals, and all the ethical questions it raised. So, Pete, I'm super glad to have you here.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Cool. Well, let's kind of just dive in. And first, I want to get your sense of going into this movie. What did you know beforehand? Like, did you know about the Eternals from comic books? Had you done some research beforehand?
No. In fact, I had. We actually covered the show on the Next Reels Film Board podcast. And so I didn't start reading the earlier books on the Eternals until I was researching for that show. So the Eternals were pretty new for me. I knew I had read some of the spoilery stuff around some of the other characters that were going to be introduced, but I went in pretty cold.
Yeah. Yeah, I was in a kind of similar place. I'd seen some stuff about how we were going to get... I'd seen some great stuff about the diversity of the cast. I'd seen some great pieces by Kumail Nanjiani about how the Herculean efforts that he had to go through to get his body to look the way it did and how he was wanted people to know, like, this is not normal, which I did think was funny because he never took his shirt off in the movie. So a lot of that effort... We saw his arms, but, like, probably on a cutting room floor somewhere.
He looked great, to his credit. He looked great if you're into that sort of superhero body type. And coming from where he had been on Silicon Valley, like, that's a triumph. I celebrate his efforts.
Yeah, and I've been a huge fan of his ever since the pseudo-rom-com he did about based on an actual story about his wife getting sick, which is another great movie that I now can't remember the name of, but I'll make sure I remember it before the end of this. But I was like you. I didn't know much. I went into it kind of cold. And, you know, today we're talking about the ethics, not the movie itself. But I'll just start by saying this is not my favorite Marvel movie by a long shot. But I think in part because of the questions we're going to get into, because I felt like the movie raised a lot of great ethical questions that I kind of wish we had more time to explore and maybe kind of think like maybe this should have been like a, you know, 6 or 8 episode Disney Plus series instead of a movie. But it definitely, you know, it kind of left me as like not my favorite movie, but a lot of great questions to dive into. What was your kind of overall thought on the movie?
Well, that was mine too. I felt like there were three sort of broad categories of challenges that I had with the movie. And so so far as I don't want to, you know, pile on because movies are hard to make. That should be, you know, the stated up front. Movies are hard. It is a work of art, right, in terms of just pushing pixels and locations and camera.
Oh, like, it's so beautiful.
It is so beautiful. I wish so deeply that the narrative actually lived up to how beautiful it is. I think there were way too many characters. It was too big, jammed too fast into too short of time. And as a result, it ended up being a 2.5-hour movie that felt like a 2.5-hour movie. Like, it felt... Yeah. Long to me. Now, the first category that we already covered on our show, which I'll sort of shy away from, but I think is foundational for my position on this film, is that it's sloppy storytelling, and you know, doing things with characters that are a little bit nonsensical. And so, once you get past the sloppy storytelling, you get into some of the more ethical, sort of moral questions that introduced conflicts in the Marvel Cinematic Universe writ large. That are not addressed to any degree of sufficiency in this movie, that are legit problematic. And that's sort of where I struggle. And finally, the size of the movie is so gargantuan that I wonder if some of the ethical questions are able to be washed away because, frankly, Celestials are so big you can't even grasp how big they are. And maybe it's okay to kill a bazillion people because they're just so big, everybody.
Well, and that's why we're going to do this podcast, because we're going to pull them back down to earth. We're going to make them have that conversation. And I do agree with you. And I think, especially actually on your second point, you know, that I have a lot of frustration that I've talked about in other episodes about the multiverse and some of the time travel stuff, because it, I think it's hard to understand, but also because it makes me wonder about the agency of everything.
Yes.
And there's a great article that I linked to that kind of raised a similar point here about, you know, why do we care about these great stories that Steve Rogers and Tony Stark and Natasha and all the rest of them have been doing if it's all just like tiny things compared to these Celestials, you know? And that's kind of an issue that Marvel's had for the most part. And I wish that with a longer story they could have done that. But I still think there is a lot of these great questions we can dive into, in part because the movie doesn't answer them. So there's a lot yes. more room for us to dive into. And so let's just start with the existence of the Eternals themselves. Like, what we learn is that these are beings that are millennia old. You know, that the Celestials, at least, what they have been doing began even before the Infinity Stones, which that changes a whole bunch of stuff about the MCU's version of reality, but that's a whole other question. And I'm sure I just got 10 angry emails explaining to me exactly how that all fits together.
Right.
That's not the point here. But so the point is that, as far as I understand, the Eternals are basically sent to a planet, and, you know, their job is to help the people of that planet grow and thrive until there's enough of them that the Celestial can sort of eat all of that. You know, basically they're they're tending the fertilizer so that the Celestial seed can grow. And that every 6,000 years or so, or however long it takes for this all to happen, 10,000 years, whatever it might be, they basically get their minds wiped and then start all over again. That alone brings up all kinds of interesting ethical questions. Like, what's your take on the existence of these beings, the Eternals, and how we're supposed to relate to them?
Well, and I would posit, before we start addressing that specific question, do any of these questions come up when you think about The Matrix, right? Because it's essentially the same story, right? We have right. the robot overlords in the sky blackens out, and then they use humans as batteries. That's what we're doing in the Eternals. And so, you know, they've just done it on such a, they've just broadened the scale in terms of just raw physics, celestial physics that might make it a little bit more challenging to actually, right. you know, conceive of what they're talking about. But I keep coming back to what it seems like they're trying to do is, like, have you ever stepped on an anthill? Like, how many ants have you inadvertently killed?
Yeah.
Ants that are at the foundation of our biological sort of ecosystem. How many have you killed because you're just so big, right?
Yeah.
That trying to recast that story by making us the ants, humans the ants, and telling the story from our perspective does present an interesting ethical narrative challenge. I think that's a fun playground.
Absolutely. And first of all, I will just say we were looking for one last guest for our podcast on the new Matrix movie that's going to come out. So thank you for just volunteering for that. I have no problem with the ethics of voluntolding people. It'll be a lot of fun, though, because one of the guests will be my father-in-law, who is a expert in AI design.
Oh, outstanding.
And he thinks the machines were right. And that we're wrong to fight the machines in the Matrix.
He's a celestial. That's the thing. He's
clearly,
a celestial.
Clearly. He's my father-in-law, so I have to say that. But getting back to our point, I think you raise a really good point. And it's interesting because it's a topic I've seen explored in other science fiction, which the MCU is sort of, kind of, not really, but the same kind of idea of, like, asking what-if questions to bring things to our own world. Mm-hmm. In particular, it reminds me of an episode of what is my current favorite Star Trek show that's on right now, The Orville. And in The Orville, there's an episode where these humans are captured and put in what is, for all intents and purposes, a zoo by a life form that is of a much higher level sentience-wise. And so for them, there's a perfect analogy of they are treating humans the way we humans treat lions and dolphins and all the other animals that we put in these pens where we try to treat them nicely, but let, you know, humans go and look at them. And you're right. Like, in this, it reminds me kind of the Loki, the Loki quote of Nick Fury is saying something to him about, like, respecting their rights. And he says, you know, what's the relationship of an anthill to a boot?
Yes.
And I think that's kind of one of the things I think most interesting here is that on that level, like, we're the boot, we're the anthill this time, so of course we care about it, but we do the kind of things that the Celestials do to others all the time. It's that the Eternals, the essence I get is that normally the Eternals are not supposed to develop, they're not supposed to start caring about the ants, and that this time they have.
Yeah, right. And you think of the other stories that Marvel has told using the same conceit. And in fact, you're already doing a podcast on it, right? Isn't the relationship of Asgard and Thor and Odin, isn't that sort of the same relationship to Midgard and humanity, you know? And so I think that's really fascinating. In this case, the Eternals, it's wrought with such tension because they feel, in large part, purposeless as exercised in the film, right? And that's a challenge that I have, because I don't understand, as an audience member, how to care. Now, from an ethical perspective, what role do they have ultimately in fostering this sort of, you know, humanity as battery for Celestial angle, when they're not going to take part in other mass casualty events, like dare we bring up Thanos, right? So what gives their notion of caring about the nature of humanity any agency at all when they're so mercurial about it?
Yeah, I think that's one of the real questions/problems I had, especially because, you know, they start out with this idea of we don't interfere. And, you know, and I... you know, Hobson's Law, I don't want to take everything to the Holocaust and to World War II, but it is, I mean, just from a pure numbers game, if your goal is to grow humanity, you know, even the Holocaust is 6 million Jews, however many million others. World War II itself is probably close to 80 or 100 million. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, they established this we won't interfere thing, which, you know, I was originally going to title this episode, I might still, The Eternals Need Uncle Ben. Because someone should be saying to them, with great power comes great responsibility. Stop Thanos. Stop Hitler. Stop the plague.
Yes.
But at the flip side, then, it seems like they're trying to play this role behind the scenes of slowly fostering human development through technology. And Festus, especially, who I think is one of my favorite characters, you know, he's put in this really interesting situation of he's trying to help develop technology. And as we don't... Again, I want more details, but I think the implication is that he develops something that causes people to, like, he maybe, like, helps inspire Einstein to figure out relativity or whatever it is that moves people towards the atom bomb. Yeah. And we get this harrowing scene of him in Hiroshima that I love. But where do you see the sort of his questioning up against this idea that all of them have of we won't interfere?
Yeah, no, it doesn't make any sense at all, does it? Because if you have a we won't interfere when the bad stuff happens, you certainly have no problem with a we interfere for anything that you perceive as good. And I need to quote somebody here, because I loved Aaron Earle's review of this movie over at the Center for Faith and Culture, because he says this, and I'm bringing it up specifically because it's your fault. He says this, following along in the footsteps of the characters, the only question to consider is how things will impact you. The probable mantra of the film, quote, when you love something, you protect it, is less with great power comes great responsibility and more you do you. And I love that, because it is a movie that is trying to recast the central sort of perspective in the film, not as a superhero or a generic, a generic vessel of sort of an audience avatar, but of as humanity, and that humanity gets to do whatever it feels right at the time. That's what the Eternals consistently demonstrate. They do whatever the hell they want, whenever they want to do it, and it feels good. And that, I think, is a real challenge. And Phaistos is one of the great exemplars of this, of, you know, trying to come up with things that will keep moving humanity forward. And if it weren't for the sardonic personalities of his peers, he would have gone bonkers with it.
Yeah. And I think that's such a great point and a great quote, and not... not surprising. I've heard a lot of other things from that place and really enjoyed them, because this is something I've talked a lot about in other episodes, that there's a very nice plot theory of, you know, there's a very nice plot trope of I'm sent here to hate these people, but I get to know them, and so now I love them.
Yes.
And that can be a heartwarming story. The problem is that when you're not able to apply the empathy beyond the specifics that you've met, you know, it's kind of what you're saying. It's the, you know, am I just protecting what I love? Is it because, you know, there should be the idea to be like, okay, well, but if I'm able to love these people who I didn't think I could love, does that mean I should still protect that other group that I haven't figured out how to love yet? And it reminds me actually of a conversation I had in college where I was talking with a couple of vegetarians. One of them was saying that she's not a real vegetarian because in her mind, like she wouldn't eat anything with a face because in her mind, like she can't eat anything cuddly. And, you know, because she was saying like she'd be happy eating like snakes or alligators because they're not cuddly. They're not cute. Mm-hmm. And this other friend of ours just laid into her and she was saying like, listen, like there's something really horribly wrong if your decision of what species you will or won't consume for food or kill for food is based on how cuddly they seem to you. You know, that's not actually a good basis for a moral understanding of things, you know?
You do you. You do yeah, you is exactly. not a basis, a moral foundation.
Yeah. No, I love that point because I hadn't even thought of it in that particular term. But you're right. It's that for each of them, it's the people who they develop an emotional relationship with. And I think by the end, some of them are able to sort of do that next step of empathy of I should now have empathy not only for them, but for the people on the other planet that the other Eternals are dealing with. But some of them just can never get to that point.
Right, right. So how does this impact your thinking on Druig and his perspective on humanity?
Ooh, he is one of my absolute favorites because he, this is a strange connection, I understand, but did you ever watch the TV show Supergirl?
Well, yes, of course I did.
Okay. I forget her name, but my favorite villain, perhaps one of my favorite villains of all time in superhero type stories is, I believe it's from the first season of Supergirl. It's Kara-El, right?
That's
her
name? Yeah.
Her mother-in-law, I believe, or someone else. But her basic plot is she's going to completely mind control every human on Earth and turn them into absolute automatons for 2 years so that they will completely fix global warming and end all the horrible things humans are doing to their planet.
Right.
And we actually had a great conversation because I remember going like, I'm not sure I would stop her. Like, you know, especially since then, like I'm all for the free will. I'm all for the autonomousness, of course. But I can understand, like, to me, there's some sympathy for you people are all making terrible decisions. I'm going to use my power and force you to do otherwise.
Yeah.
And to me, and I don't know if this is the question you were thinking about, but to me, Druig is in a very place like that where I am still in the end going to come down on the side of agency and convincing people to make a good decision. But, you know, he brings up similar things. He talks about how humanity is destroying the planet. Now these terrible things are happening and that he could just, you know, if you could just mind control Hitler and Stalin and stop the armies from attacking, if you could just mind control the people who make the bomb and make them, you know, put, you know, whatever it is. And obviously there's so much more global complexity and all these larger things. But yeah, in the end, I think he's probably wrong, but I think he's incredibly sympathetic and that I would be very tempted to make the same kind of decisions in his place.
Well, because he's ultimately sort of the character that displays the most empathy of the lot, right? He just has a much more sort of activist position on it. I think, just so I get it right, I think you're talking about Astra in the first season.
Astra,
of
yes,
Supergirl.
Thank you.
Yeah, just so you don't get a letter. which was a fantastic storyline, and I just love it. I think about that, and it breaks my heart a little bit that the show has ended because I've always liked that in terms of the DC CW shows. I stand conflicted on Druig, I think, for many of the same reasons, because I feel like he is the one that has said that I can, through my great power, exercise what I believe strongly is my responsibility and help you stop killing each other, right? I can help you stop behaving badly. And I don't believe that's, like, ideologically, that's right, but it sure does stop people from killing each other.
Yeah.
And that's a hard line to walk. And so for the same reason, just because he is such a... you know, he it feels like he cares so deeply to me, that it makes it really interesting to watch. And the fact that he's the one who is taking action first.
You know, one of the things that I think of with Druig is, I'm not a parent, but this analogy occurred to me, and I've talked to a couple parents who say that they understand this. You know, you want to teach your child to make the right choice. And yes. So you might say to the child, here's why you shouldn't hit someone else. You know, don't do this. Here's all the reasons why. But there's also a moment where if your child somehow got a hold of a very big stick, you're not going to say, hey, Johnny, please. You're going to go over and grab the stick because right. You know that the one thing they're doing right now could cause incredible damage. And to me, I kind of feel, to me, that's kind of Druig's conflict here, is that he, on the one hand, he wants humanity to make these decisions for themselves, perhaps, or at least that's what everyone else wants. But he sees that, like, time's running out. You know, they could destroy the planet. They could destroy each other.
Yes. I think that is my central conflict with Druig, because, right. You know, as a parent, to extend the metaphor, as a parent, what you ideally are doing is spending your life parenting for those first, you know, 16 years, 18 years, trying to not exert your authority in that right. way, right? You're moving away from it. And Druig is doing exactly the opposite, right? He demonstrates in Babylon that he is willing to exercise his power to stop humans from killing themselves. And then he goes and leaves the Eternals and creates his own little cult commune of people yeah. who are not killing each other because they're all mind controlled by him. And I think that's really the complexity of Druig, and that's what makes his character a bit redemptive in terms of the narrative of the film for me, because he's the mm-hmm. one of the most interesting to watch.
Yeah.
Because he's essentially not wrestling with this choice at all. He has yeah. already made that bed and he's moved on, and everybody else gets to just sort of revolve around him.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. I think it's part of why his story becomes so interesting. And so let's talk about some of the other, pulling back, though, to just kind of the Eternals overall.
Yeah.
Because let's start with kind of what then becomes their central question of, like, do you or do you not allow the Celestial to be born? And I think there's two elements to it. One is the, you know, do the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few versus do the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the many, many more yet to come?
Mm-hmm.
Put a pin in that question. I just want to start with going kind of where you were starting with. If we understand that we as humans, you know, that we're raised to only morally value some things, and a lot of human development is expanding the world of who we think is morally valuable, you know, that a lot of us are taught, like, it's only people who look like us are the ones who are valuable, and, like, we have to expand that and care more about other people.
Right.
Some of my vegetarian or vegan friends would say that we need to push ourselves and care more about animals. But still, even for us, there's a point, you know, the anthill is something that we're probably not going to have the same moral weight of as a person. And we can argue about that, but I think it's something that most humans kind of accept as a moral, acceptable thing. From that perspective, someone like Icarus, you know, if he's raised all of his life to understand, or at least, you know, he learns later that these humans are small and insignificant and they are the anthill that's going to get moved out of the way for this great, wonderful Celestial that will lead to trillions and trillions of new lives. From his perspective, is he wrong?
That may be the central failing of the movie, is not adjusting our expectations of perspective. Mm-hmm. And maybe intentionally on Chloe Zhao's part, but I feel like I really struggled with that because I was never given the opportunity to see the world from the perspective of a Celestial, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you pull back and put me in the eyes of the Celestial, and I see a planet shaped or an egg shaped planet erupting with a new baby Celestial, before I get to the point of hearing about the story, I may change my view, right? I may change my view of the value of their lives over the lives of those on the planet from which I sit, and so I think that rides the line between that ethical and storytelling challenge that I think the movie was trying to walk and did so unsuccessfully. Is he wrong? I don't know, didn't Douglas Adams already sort of answer that question in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Like, make room for the highway? The answer is 42, man.
Yeah,
the answer is
42. The Vorlons need to...
That's right.
Vorlons, very different story. The Vogons
need to build their
galactic
bypass. Yes, I know. You tricked me. You totally tricked me. Yes, it is the Vogons. That's exactly right. And so, I think that's the question that I want to be more satisfying, that the movie has a perspective on. And I almost don't think it does. And that's what makes this conversation hard. Was he wrong? Do you think?
First of all, just in terms of the movie making, I definitely hear what you're saying. And I feel like my sense is that Chloe Zhao wanted to make a movie that really presented Icarus as, within his own context, just as morally righteous as someone else,
Cersei,
as just as morally righteous as Cersei or someone else, and that kind of left the audience to decide. I think where it clashed is, I think you could have told that story. I think that runs up into the MCU need to have a big fight with lots of CGI and a clear winner and a clear loser at the end.
And let me just say, I'm a big fan of big battles. Like, I like big battles as much as the next guy. But I do think that this is a missed opportunity to really investigate the weight of sort of zealotry, of right. ideological fanaticism in Icarus. Yeah. And maybe because of, again, filmmaking, maybe because the casting and the portrayal of the character was not sufficient, maybe because of the storytelling challenges that we're having here and scripting challenges. Either way, the movie is an empty promise of a discussion of fanaticism. And since the whole movie sort of has to be, it's hanging its hat on fanaticism, that's why the Eternals are there, right? Yeah. It's the whole premise is because they believe so strongly in the will of the Celestials, of their God.
And I wouldn't even call it fanaticism because this is all they've ever known. You know, fanaticism to me is when
everyone post-indoctrination.
Around you, it's kind of like it's a fanaticism of the parents who join the cult are fanatics. The kids who are born into the cult, you know, are part of a fanatical movement, to be sure, but in a different way. The conversation I think I would have most wanted to see, because I think it could have given you kind of what you're asking for, as well as some of the other stuff, is the conversation between Ajak and Icarus. You know, Ajak is the one who presumably has known about this all the time. And, we get to see where Ajak changes her mind. And then you have, again, a very fanatical moment. You know, the leader convinces the follower. But then when the leader changes their mind, the follower kills the leader for their heresy. I want to see the moment where... You know, where I want to see more of Ajak when she did believe, because I, as a human, obviously, I don't want to see myself obliterated. I think that's bad.
I have a perspective on that. Right.
Yeah. And I would like to say that maybe therefore the standard of value of life is at sentience or at like some kind of level of, you know, the difference between like vegetation versus animal life. Or I'm not a biologist. I'm not the one to draw the line, but I would like to say there's an objective line, but clearly it's incredibly subjective. And I do think that there's a way in which, like, it's so interesting because to me it's kind of, I'm very intentionally not saying, like, what is objectively right or wrong, because I don't think that you can. I think the question is it understandable that from Icarus's moral perspective, where he sees what he sees, that what he does is maybe horrible to us, but it's only horrible to us in the way that what we do is horrible to the ants, you know? So to me, it's a missed opportunity, but it still at least gives us the ability to ask the question, because I think the movie's doing a very good job of making us like sort of pull that lens back and ask ourselves like, if Icarus is wrong, then where are we wrong?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I support that point, because more of the problems that I have with that whole exchange and with Ajax's role in the Eternals and in the film, The Eternals, these are filmmaking challenges that I have. These are story structure challenges that I have, not the sort of ethical, sort of moral discussion between Icarus and Ajak. I think there was more opportunity to plumb those depths that they did not take. But from your question, Icarus is demonstrating his ideological worldview consistently, arguably through to the end of the film when he has his turn. And that is of merit, right?
Yeah.
What we get is this whole, what we're missing is in this final battle and possibly lost in the pixel pushing of the big Marvel sort of extravaganza at the end is a more sort of rich exploration of the savior versus the exploiter trope, right?
Yeah. Say more on that.
When it is discovered that the Celestials, that the God is actually exploiting this resource, right? That this thing that they were all ostensibly following, whether they were indoctrinated into this cult-like fanaticism or whether they were born into it or, in mm-hmm. the Eternals' case, built into it, they are following this thing. And when they learn that this is actually a tool of exploitation of a natural resource on a planetary scale, that's the thing that triggers their awakening, their awareness that something is right. wrong. And I feel like that is sort of lost in the, I don't know where the North Icelandic Sea, somewhere with the fingertips of the new Celestial coming out and frozen in stasis there.
I think that's supposed to be in like kind of the archipelagos of the South Pacific.
Oh, okay.
With my memory from the map.
Yeah. Where would I end up with Iceland? It was not Iceland.
I mean, certainly I feel like there are some tsunamis that are going to be formed.
Yeah.
And it does. And again, this is a movie making problem, but it's the sort of thing that's more an issue of the MCU itself. We are now at the point where someone like Doctor Strange or Hulk or someone else should have thought, wow, those are monsters I'm seeing on TV attacking London, and there's earthquakes, and maybe I should figure out what's going on. Putting that critique aside, I've had this ever since Spider-Man was hanging out in New York City while dragons were coming to life in downtown Manhattan, and Spider-Man didn't notice. Other story entirely.
Yeah.
It gets to what I think is one of the most interesting questions about all this is the idea of subjectivity. That mm-hmm. in general, we want people to have somewhat objective ideas of right and wrong, so that it's not just, well, if a total stranger does something, then it's wrong. But if a person who I care about does the exact same thing, I care about their motives so I can believe them, even if I don't believe this other person, And this is one thing that I'm always very critical in movies like this, where someone will say, wow, this villain is much more relatable and much more sympathetic than this other villain. And my question is always, is that just because the other villain didn't get a backstory?
Sure.
Every villain's going to think they're a hero to some extent. And I think here's the question that I'm kind of wrestling with is, because I don't think it's that the Eternals have some sort of moral awakening. I think it's that they develop feelings for humans. And so my question is,
well, I'd like to hear more about that. Like, what is the difference between those two? Because aren't they sort of the same thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. It's the difference between, I have come to realize that in my ethical framework, doing this thing is wrong, versus I'm fine with you doing this thing to those people over there.
To another planet.
Right, but I care about these people here. It's that whole thing of like, you've taught me to care about this group, but I still don't care about that other group. But where it comes down to me for is, and I'm curious if you have an answer on this, in theory, the Eternals have been doing this on planet after planet after planet without a problem, including this particular group of Eternals have done it on many other planets. So what's different this time? Why is it that this time, humans are wonderful that a lot of these things default to, that I always kind of raise my eyebrows out? Is it just pure chance or luck? What makes this planet for the Eternals different, do you think?
A story flag. We are assuming that their minds, their memories are dutifully erased before each engagement, right?
Right, yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know. Is it the power of love, Matthew? Is that ultimately it? Is it the power of having two former Game of Thrones stars on screen at the same time? Is it the power of just Dane Whittington's or Whitman's steely stare? That feels like a little bit of a little bit of hand-wavy romanticism that makes this time different, and it is ill-explained. I certainly don't have an answer.
Yeah, I think that's where I get lost as well, because I want to know that. I want to know what is it that makes them, you know, because I think it, to some extent, it starts with Ajak. Like, what is it that makes her question this one in a way that, you're right, it's not that she's done it 10 times before. Every time she's starting from a blank slate, at least as I understand it.
That was my understanding, too, although I think that was, again, story flag. It was not clear in her flashback story to Icarus whether or not she, as the leader of this group, had some sort of additional awareness of what was going on with the Celestials and what her role was in it.
Right.
I was not clear about that.
Yeah. And I think that's what I was saying about the subjectivity thing. I think for me that ties into what you're saying about survivor versus exploiter, is that it's how much does it become about your own, you know, to me there's a big difference between I want to do the right thing versus I want people to see that I do the right thing versus I want to believe I'm the person who does the right thing, you know? And like to go back to Druig with his mind control, you know, when we're talking about objective versus subjective, I think one of the things that, again, the movie doesn't name, but I wish we had more time, they kind of name it a bit, is it's easy to claim that you believe on an objective level that you can best help people by totally taking control of them. But on a subjective level, you probably enjoy the power of that quite a bit, you know? And to me, one of the most interesting and at times destructive stories in all of morality is it is very easy for the human mind, and I guess maybe the eternal mind, to find a way to morally justify that which feels comfortable to us. And so, yeah, I have to wonder with Druig, with any of these, like how much of it is, you know, an ethical decision versus just, I like these people. I don't want to kill them.
I like these people.
Which is
I don't
a good thing,
them,
to be sure.
Or,
like, that's,
yeah, I sure like these people doing nice things to one another and keeping my mindless commune going, right? I mean, so much of that, specifically from Druig's perspective, is in the capable hands of Barry Keoghan as the portrayer of this character, because he is so good at exuding his love of the power of it, right? I think he actually portrays that exceptionally well. And we get a giant pixel-pushing forest battle about it, right? I think that is a real reason to sort of celebrate a high point in the movie that allows us to see his power and his influence and the way he uses his power and address an MCU need that they have to have, right, as a beat in a big movie. I don't think many of the other, like if you go back to Phaistos and his exploration of his own power, and that I think is another one that is more complex than just I can make spears out of gold fiber and fight real hard, right? It is a more complex sort of ability that I think is unexplored, or I should say underexplored, because we don't ever get a chance to see Phaistos, you know, like really building his ultimate sort of home. We get a brief scene of the bomb, which I think we both feel unrequited about that exploration. And then he takes himself out of the picture. And so I think this merits kind of that individual. We started with Ajak, but it merits sort of an individual sort of beat by beat. Like, what did these people do, the Eternals, that with their time...
Yeah.
Not being a part of the crew, because there are both ethical and story problems.
Yeah. And I think it's why I keep thinking about this in terms of what it could have been in, like, you know, an 8 to 10 episode series, because you'd get so much more time to sit with the characters and also learn how each of their reactions is related to each other. You know, to me, I don't know if we saw this connection directly, but as I would understand it, what Druig does is a direct reaction to what Festus goes through, you know, of he wanted to teach people and hope they would make the right decision and then had his heart broken by them making the wrong decision.
Yes.
Druig looks at that and goes, I have a solution. If they never make a decision, they'll never break my heart. And that's, it's a subjective thing. It's the, yes, you are doing good for these others, but you're also protecting yourself. You know, I am not a parent, but I've heard many parents say that, like, one of the hardest parts about being a parent is letting your child fail, letting your child make the wrong decision.
Is it this, that, like, do you have any cats? Right? Like, isn't this why humans have house cats versus, you know, cats who live outside? Because we don't want them to get sick or fleas, or we don't want them to get hurt or hit by a car, right? Like, it is part of the challenge of becoming a caretaker. And so much of this movie is they're trying to show as many possible perspectives of caretaking and the ideology of caretaking by way of weaving it in and out of these individuals in the Eternals. And sometimes it works. And then you're Kingo and you just leave.
Kingo was such a great character in so many ways.
And why did they let him leave? That I'm 100% with you. He was a great character. And he just takes his ball and goes home.
Right? I wanted to see what happens to him in between him saying, I think Icarus is right, I'm walking away, and then coming back to rejoin the fight, you know?
Yes.
Especially because I have to imagine somewhere in a script or somewhere on a cutting room floor is the footage of him and his valet talking. Because in many ways, the valet is such a great character because he is the human among them, you know, and he is the one who can sort of be like, you know, for Kingo to have that moment of like connecting with him. I mean, it was hilarious.
His final bit, Karun's final bit, where he walks out and says, thank you, Eternals, for fighting on behalf of humanity. And, you know, taking liberties with that line. But it was a great example of the kind of emotional resonance that we needed elsewhere in the film, in even more important moments, not when they're writing Kumail Nanjiani out of the film for a while.
Yeah. It's too bad because he's such a good actor.
So good.
So let's get to the elephant that we've been dancing around this whole time. Yeah. And it's because I think there's a lot of other, you know, other life forms that are interesting, but elephants deserve attention too. Needs of the many versus the needs of the many, 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 many yet to come.
Okay, fair.
What's your
fair
take?
Interpretation? Again, this is a massive massive lift in this movie that they're trying to make us feel, and I have been since you invited me to have this conversation, knowing the kinds of conversations you have on this show and the fact that you just asked the incredibly provocative question, do the Jedi need an HR office? I am
that's
wondering,
our last episode.
I am wondering where you landed on this. Are you a Spock or a Kirk?
I think it's hard. I'm going to talk about the failing of the movie first, but then I'll address the question as I think they're trying to raise it. Which is that, in part, you're right, because we never see things from the perspective of the Celestials or even the Eternals who believe in them, I'm left to wonder if they're a reliable narrator. You know, if they're saying something, I want my brother to be born. Oh, and by the way, even though my brother will kill a billion people or 7 billion people, my brother will create the life of all of these others. I want someone other than you to tell me that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of, like, I remember, I know it was, like, mentioned, but I remember at one point I said to my spouse as we were watching the movie, like, wait a minute, what's exactly the bad thing that will happen if the Celestial doesn't be born? Because I didn't quite understand because the movie didn't really explain it to me. But if we assume that all of it is true, I have to go back to, you have to take the reality of what is over the potential, you know, and this is a weird place for it, but it becomes part of it's from where my own history is. And I've talked about this before, so hopefully I won't lose too many subscribers here, but I spent the first 15 years of my career in reproductive justice work, you know, around like, you know, abortion rights and parental rights and all that kind of stuff. And a part of that is the idea of, you know, the actual life of the person who's carrying the pregnancy versus all the potential of the fetus. And I'm not trying to make an argument of that. I think that there's so much complexity to that. It's much more than anyone's slogan on any side can be, though I have my particular political leanings on it that are very much over to the left. But to me, in some way, it's kind of a similar idea. It's, do you allow the birth of a new creation if the birth is going to kill the host? And does the host have the ability to say, no, thank you, we're going to terminate this? And I don't think the MCU is trying to make an abortion parable writ large because they don't like controversy.
Yeah.
but they kind of did. And I think if I'd had more attention to the Eternals, to the Celestials, maybe I could have come down on that side. And I have to recognize my own subjectivity. I'm a human. It's hard for me to accept the idea that my life is not morally significant in a grander scheme of things. But the way they frame the question here, at least, I don't think that it is.
You don't think that it is? You think the Celestial should have been born?
No. I think they were right to stop the Celestial being born.
All right. Yeah. I think they are too, but part of it, again, story flag, is because we've never met the Celestials. I don't think they made a hell of a good case about why we need Celestials, right? Yeah. Is it really the one that we meet enough? Like, doesn't he do enough? Do we really need to bear another one? So that's a story flag that I have. I didn't feel in favor of the Celestials at all.
And I would just add to that, they actually go to great efforts to make the Celestials appear malevolent.
Yes, they do.
You know, red eyes, the booming voice. And then when Cersei has stood up to them and she's kind of just yoinked out to another part of the galaxy in what seems to be to stand trial or face punishment, none of that makes me believe that Celestials have our best intentions at heart. So I think we're right about the story problem. But assuming... Take all that away. Let's assume you do believe that everything the Celestials will say, is it okay to blow up Earth for the creation of all this other life that will come next?
Yeah, and I think ultimately what the movie is trying to wrestle with is if you have the means to stop it, right? Let us weigh the value of collected humanity against one Celestial. Collective versus the one we should be able to put those on the scales of justice. And now add to the fact that we have the ability to stop this thing. We don't know what the repercussions are. We don't know how long this stoppage might last. Something else will come of it. We know because there are post-credit scenes. But what we have now is the power to exude our metaphysical authority over this thing and stop it. And therefore, we did, right?
Right.
We did. And so get rid of all of the other questions of where the hell are the other superheroes? I don't know, because we just happen to have the right, you know, three or four of them here to make this job work. Mm-hmm. I think made the case that the value of humanity was greater than the value of the one Celestial, no matter how very, very big that Celestial is.
Right. And even there, though, it's a case like, because the many outweigh the needs of the one, but also remember the bias of it, you know?
Yeah.
There are millions and millions of bacteria cells that live in my body when I get an infection. And I decide that the needs of the one, me, are more important than those millions of living cells.
Right.
Living bacterium or virus or whatever they are.
The fact that all of the billions of life forms that are supposedly coming later are potential life forms.
Right.
They do not exist here and now. And I think that is that's the sort of it's not a tightrope to say at all that the value of a life here and now is higher than the value of a life that is not even conceived.
I was pretty frustrated with the whole what if project because it didn't stay with what if. It just became
another story
to introduce characters into the multiverse. But if the what if storytelling went back to it, here's a what if I would love to see. I would love to see another version of the Eternals where it's set on a completely different planet, but they probably look a lot like us and, you know, like aliens do, but they have weird ears or something. But something that is very relatable for us as humans in the audience. And we come to understand that the characters are facing the same struggle, except we know because of the power of what if that the Celestial that wants to be born to destroy this planet will create Earth.
I see what you've done now.
Because to me, I am always going to come back to how subjective are our ethics, you know? And
right.
if it's, would
that
we
would be,
be
a great what if episode,
right?
For sure.
Like,
for
what,
sure.
Would we feel the same way on the other side? Would we be totally okay with these people not being destroyed, but so that our potentiality was never created, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But again, you cannot, it would be a stretch for What If, for the team of writers of What If, to effectively, like, convince us that the Earth that they would create is exactly the Earth that we are protective of right now, if it is an Earth that did not exist. And so, again, it goes back to a life that exists here and now is of greater import than a life that has not been manifested by this God.
Right. Exactly. I think that's a good way to put it. Let's we're almost an hour. I don't want to go too long. So let's turn to, like, the one last ethical question that I really want to talk about from this movie. And this is pulling the lens back a little, because this is more the ethics of filmmaking than the ethics of the film. But it's a topic that we've talked about quite a lot, which is representation. And I do just want to kind of lift up, I love how much broader the representation is in this movie in terms of having, like, an openly gay character, or at least an openly queer character, an openly, you know, a disabled, a deaf character, far more, you know, representation of groups like South Asian and things like that. I'm both so happy for it. I also, though, have a little bit of a feeling of, so, like, we want a gay main character, you give us 1 out of 10. We want a disabled main character, you give us 1 out of 10. You know, it's both great, and I want all of the movies to have this level of diversity, but it feels a little weird that they shoved all the diversity into this one movie, where it feels all much like, yeah, you don't like the gay character? Don't worry, he's only on screen for 5 minutes, and then you'll get somebody else. Forgive the very cynical side of me here, but...
It is. You're only a touch jaded. A little bit. Just a little bit. I'm on the fence there too, because I feel like I deeply appreciate that. What I have to imagine, my headcanon is that Chloe Zhao came in and said, "This is the kind of cast we're going to build."
Yeah.
Because you know, in spite of all our intentionality, Kevin Feige is a middle-aged white man. And there is a certain perspective that needs to be balanced against that, right?
Yes.
In a position of authority at Marvel. And I think that the powers that be, I have this sense that the powers that be, or let's say a sense of optimism, that the powers that be in making this movie decided, we're going to have a cast that looks like this. It's going to be made up of women and men, and they will be made up of varying shades of color across the spectrum. And also, we will absolutely represent sexual identity as well, and sexuality as well. We're going to represent that somehow. And also, have you seen how many characters we're putting in here? There's just a lot of characters, and eventually we kind of run out of steam on the checklist. But it's hard not to see that as tokenism. Like, it's just new tokenism. And I want to give the right amount, the judicious amount of credit where credit is truly due. The fact that I have a 15-year-old son, and we went to this movie together, and he noticed those things, Matthew, right? This is a teenager who stopped and said, this is a Marvel movie, and those dudes are kissing, and that's great, right? Yeah. That is respect that this is happening. There were naked people on a beach rolling around getting it on in this movie.
Which, by the way, only the second sex scene in all of the MCU movies, going back to the Iron Man, Tony and the Reporter.
Yes.
You know, so the ever-purient MCU, at least on film, is becoming...
They know how to pull back the curtain a little bit.
Yeah. And I will say, we got, at least, you know, on to my fan stuff, I got at least one email being like, I hated this movie because I wanted to take my child to it, but it had a sex scene. And my super sex positive self, who... used to teach sex ed. I have a couple responses for that. That's not
story. I know. I struggle because I'm pretty sex positive too, and I'm pretty sex positive. I only say that because I'm wildly sex positive. Let's have all the more sex. And so, I struggle with that. But I want to give credit that they didn't write it out because they coulda. So
I think that's where I come down. Is to me. Because I think things like the story of your son is so important. The story of. I've heard from deaf fans who were just in tears in this movie because they'd never seen themselves on screen in that way, especially because that actress is, you know, deaf herself. Like, that was not a hearing actress who learned ASL.
This is Lauren Ridloff that we're talking
about here. Like, they made sure, like, that they were able to have – and it's not the first time. Like, Marlee Matlin has done some great acting as well. But certainly in a superhero movie, you know, the first time we've had major South Asian representation this way. To me, it's more that it's like – I want to note the fact that they did it in this ensemble as a like, okay, this is a good first step. I still want a gay main character. I still want a, I still want main characters who check all the boxes. But yeah, for me, yeah, it's not, I wouldn't say, oh, so this is no good, so don't do this. You know, it's like the two women kissing at the end of, you know, the last Star Wars movie. Like, it's, that's not good enough, but it's a step, and it's a good thing.
Yeah, I think that is the, that's the measure against which they should be judged. Not how much haven't they done, but how much do they continue to pepper into these mass market creations that have to address so many different ideological needs around the planet. And it's only getting harder to do that and to push those boundaries. So I'm trying to soften a little bit my personal sense of insult that they haven't done more, and continue to applaud when they do something so that they know I love it and my family loves it, and we want to see more representation of the world as we are living it. The complex tapestry of people across, you know, across the multiverse of fluidities that exist, right? And so, you know, from neurodiversity to sexuality to gender identity, the works.
Yeah, I think that's such a great way to put it, especially, you know, because the flip side is an ensemble should be the place where you see the most diversity because you have the most people,
people.
So like the opposite of like, so you, if these 10 people are supposed to represent Earth, they can't all just be European. You know, that wouldn't make any sense, let alone be horribly racist.
Yeah.
So, it's
but you can also hear how somebody on the team would be saying, but Lauren Ridloff is a woman, she's a person of color, and she's deaf. That's three checkboxes.
Right. And I think it's important to be critical. Like, that's the thing is when I'm going to come down on it is if in 3 years we've gotten all straight cis superheroes and someone pushes a Marvel executive and say, well, but we had Festus in, you know, Eternals. Isn't that good enough? Like, no, that's
it is not good enough.
Yeah,
we'll judge that against the 3 years from now bar.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? So
continue to push.
So I think that's about all I had in terms of stuff to bring up. I mean, we could do episode upon episode upon episode, but unlike perhaps this movie, I want to have some good editing and stick to as much as we can and be requited in our ethical discussions. Any other last points or questions you wanted to bring up, though?
I don't feel like I would be doing justice to those questions by bringing anything up as we lean into our closing credits. But I would just like to say I deeply appreciate the invitation. I love this conversation. I have truly enjoyed our conversations on Discord, and love that you invited me to continue them with you here.
No, my pleasure. It's been so great for me to be part of the Next Real family of podcasts because, you know, I approach filmmaking in terms of the story it tells me. And being part of the Marvel Movie Minute and doing Next Reel and the Film Board and other stuff with you and with Andy has given me so much more of an education about, you know, what's actually happening in terms of like when this shot is doing this thing and all the stuff about movies that I don't even recognize but that are telling the story. I am going to that whole description you gave about why you didn't think Eternals worked and how you said that you thought it kind of got lost too much in the artistry of it and like not the storytelling and it was a little bit long, and I'm just going to play that back to you the next time you ask me why I don't like Dune, because I think all of that applies to Dune. But that being said, you know, I love these conversations. It's great. And if you and I ever get truly, truly, truly bored, minute by minute Babylon 5.
I don't need to get all that bored to do that kind of a show with you, Matthew.
I know. I'd
stand
love to
await.
I would at least do episode by episode Babylon 5, but still, that would be committing to a long period of my life.
Yes,
anyway,
it would.
Pete, for those who want to hear more of your stuff, like I've talked about Next Reel, but tell us a little more about the specific podcasts you're on and how people can find them.
Well, I'm on really too many podcasts at this point to talk about, but you can find me at truestory.fm, where you can find all the podcasts, including the podcasts of The Next Reel. In terms of The Next Reel, if you're into movies, we're about to hit, goodness, episode 1,000 is coming up in the coming weeks. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary on November 11th, and so it was really fun to look at the community that's built up around all of the shows that we do. But truestory.fm is where you can find everything that we do in the podcast space, movie-related and non.
Yeah, check it out. There's so much good stuff happening there, from some very serious reviews to stuff like Saturday Matinee, where you guys just have so much fun with things. An earlier episode did a great thing on, they basically did a bracketology of horror movies, where somehow in terms of like the best, they're looking at the best presentations of, you know, a Frankenstein, a Dracula, a mummy, or,
Wolfman.
Wolfman. And, the Rocky from Rocky Horror Picture Show got fairly high up in the Frankenstein category, as did the Frankenstein from Young Frankenstein from Mel Brooks. So that had me there. So, Pete, thank you so much. Thank you to all of us, to all of you at Next Reel for welcoming there. To our fans, what do you think? Like, this movie has already caused a lot of, you know, some people love it, some people don't, and that's totally fine. Let's get in other controversies. What do you think? What do you is anyone out there also on Team Icarus or even Team Celestial? Do you think we're completely wrong and the movie was pretty clear and Cersei forever? What do you think? You can send feedback to us by searching for The Ethical Panda on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at EthicalPanda77. Unfortunately, The Ethical Panda was too long a name by one character, hence EthicalPanda77. You can email me at TheEthicalPanda@gmail.com. Or, of course, just go to TheEthicalPanda.com. There you'll find this podcast, my Star Wars Universe podcast, all the stuff I'm doing on Marvel Movie Minute, and a couple other podcasts that I've had a great pleasure to be a part of. We're just starting to get into our coverage of The Witcher. We're going to kind of do some reviews of Season 1 to then be able to talk about Season 2 on Bingers Assemble. All the new Star Wars stuff that's coming out, I'm definitely going to be all over. It's going to be a great time. So thank you all very much for being fans, and have a great day.